The murder of an 18-year-old girl in Graves County, Kentucky, went unsolved for years. Until a local housewife, a journalist, and a handful of girls came forward with a story.
America, y'all better wake the hell up. Bad things happen to good people in small towns.
Listen to Graves County on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And to binge the entire season ad-free, subscribe to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of the On Purpose podcast. Recently, I had a conversation with the one and only Madonna.
When I was broke and I had no friends, nowhere to live, I was held up at gunpoint, I was robbed, all these horrendous things happened to me. I had such an unhappy childhood that whatever happened to me in New York is better than what my life was, so I'm not going back.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
When I told people I was making a podcast about Benghazi, 9 times out of 10, they called me a masochist, rolled their eyes, or just asked, why?
Benghazi, the truth became a web of lies.
From Prologue Projects and Pushkin Industries, this is Fiasco, Benghazi.
What difference at this point does it make?
Listen to Fiasco, Benghazi on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
During the late 1980s, Federico Lobe was routinely harassed by St. Louis police officers Reuben Hammond and James Long, who previously attempted to convict him on what appeared to have been fabricated charges. Then, on May 21st, 1988, a woman claimed that she had been raped and sodomized, and officers Hammond and Long had prepared a lineup for her in which she identified someone who did not match her initial description, their recurring target, Federico Lobe. But despite multiple factors that damaged the credibility of this ID, Federico was sent away for 85 years. This is Wrongful Conviction.
You're listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts.
Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction, where we head to St. Louis, Missouri, to discuss not only rape and sodomy allegations, but also a damning backstory that alone casts doubt on this conviction. But before we introduce the man who has been surviving this ordeal for decades and decades now, we're joined once again by his attorney from Centurion Ministries, Paul Castellaro. Paul, thanks for coming back.
My pleasure.
And with us today, calling in from a Missouri correctional facility, we have Federico Lobe. I'm sorry you're there, but we appreciate you calling in.
Definitely. You're welcome.
So tell us about growing up in St. Louis.
I had 4 brothers and 2 sisters. We all grew up in the St. Louis Housing Project. My mother and father, they were good people, man. You know, my mother, she was a substitute school teacher. She was also a cafeteria supervisor for St. Louis Public Schools. My father, he drove a truck for the 7-Up Company. And growing up in the projects, you have to have something to do. And I took up boxing. I was pretty good at one time. And so I was going to school and I was boxing. And I had a job also. I worked at a place called Span Build and Maintenance, where we cleaned office buildings at.
Unfortunately, in 1981, he caught a gun charge that sent him away for a 45-day stint, but also introduced him to the Moorish Science Temple of America.
As a direct result of me serving that time, I was able to go to one of the meetings for the Moorish Science Temple of America, and I became a part of the organization. Our prophet, Noble Drew Ali, he brought Islam to the United States of America. And in the Moorish Science Temple of America, we teach nationality and divine creed. We teach that blacks are not Negro, black, colored, Ethiopian, or anything else other than Moors. And we know that the Moors are from the northwestern shores of Africa. You have to proclaim your nationality as being a Moorish American and denounce the name Negro, black, colored, and Ethiopian, and all names that delude to slavery. So all the Moors in the United States of America identified as Bays or Els, E-L. or B-E-Y.
Just like the leader of the Moorish Science Temple in St. Louis, Jerry Lewis Bay, this surname signified a connection to their African roots, as folks were escaping the Jim Crow South during the Great Migration to northern cities. And over the following decades, the group fractured into other Muslim organizations, including the Nation of Islam, which my own late father-in-law, Muhammad Ali, famously joined back in the 60s.
I remember when Muhammad Ali became Muhammad Ali, and he joined the Nation of Islam. Cassius Clay is now Muhammad Ali. And the kind of prevailing thought was that these people were really, they're dangerous. We should be afraid of them because they've kind of gotten out of, I guess, our mainstream Christianity, Judaism kind of track. And now all of a sudden you're bringing in this foreign kind of religion.
And that still is the prevailing trend in many pockets of American culture, and certainly appears to have been for the officers in this case. Reuben Hammond and James Long, who seem to have been just really interested in Frederico back in July of 1987.
Yeah, I had gotten out of a car. A guy dropped me off at my house, went up to my apartment building where my girlfriend and my two children were. Next thing we knew, my doorbell rang, and when I opened the door, Officer Long had his pistol in my face and told me to get my hands up. And I asked him, I said, what's this all about? He said, you ran from me, and you threw some drugs down while you was running from me. I said, I didn't throw no drugs down. I ain't never have no drugs. I get down to the police department, and that's when he told me that I was being charged with possession of potent drugs and marijuana. Once they saw that I had made bond, these same officers came back less than a week and a half away. This was in July of 1987. They saw me entering my apartment building with my girlfriend and our children. These same officers jumped out and told me to get my hands up. Officer Heyman had his gun pointed in my face, and Long had his gun pointed at my girlfriend. And he asked her who she was. He wrote her name, her number, and everything, date of birth and all the stuff down. And while he was writing it down, he was asking her where we was coming from. Did we have any narcotics on us? Did we have any weapons on us? And she said, we don't have anything on us. And said, well, this motherfucker is wanted for a first degree assault. So they took me and threw me in the back seat of the police car and told me that they was locking me up again. And I wasn't going to make bond on this charge. So I kept asking them, who am I supposed to have assaulted? And he said, you'll find out when we get to the station. And they kept asking me questions about one of our spiritual leaders in the Moorish Science Temple of America, Jerry Lewis Bay. And how do I fit into the situation of the Moorish Science Temple of America? And I told him, look, man, I'm not finna tell you anything. He said, all you motherfuckers are just alike. He cussed me out and called me a bunch of derogatory names. And he said, yeah, we did a little research on you, and we know what you're about. He said, all you fucking gangsters are just alike.
One of the arresting cops testified in the civil trial that he believed that any member of that temple was a criminal.
Jerry Lewis Bay was later prosecuted in a RICO trial, and it's unclear whether the charges were based in reality or just another instance of the targeted destruction of a black leader, or maybe both. Either way, it appears that these officers may have been targeting Frederico to get to Jerry Lewis Bay.
He kept asking me questions about Jerry Lewis Bay, and I kept telling him, I said, I ain't going to tell you shit, man. And he said, yeah, we know what you guys are about. And you one of them, and you're going to learn today. And I was like, what the fuck is you talking about? I'm going to learn today. He got mad at me and reached in the back, and he had a slapjack in his hand. And then he hit me with it, which caused blood to trickle down on the right side of my face, right above my eye. And once we entered the garage, Heyman drugged me out of the back seat. And while I'm down on the ground, they started kicking me and hit me with their flashlight. And so they locked me up, and it was a sergeant that came in and took the handcuffs up off me. He said, what happened to your face? You must have ran into the wall. He booked me, took my fingerprints and all that, and then placed me back in the cell. And he said, they caught you with some drugs in the July the 12th arrest that they made, and we want to know where you're getting these drugs from that you're selling out there. I said, I didn't have no drugs. I said, but I'm not locked up on this time for no drugs. He said that I had assault. Come find out. He used the information that my girlfriend gave him about who she was, and wrote the police report out that I was assaulting her.
This assault arrest never materialized into an indictment, but the drug possession allegations made it to trial in April of 1988.
Heyman and Long, they testified that he had marijuana and he dropped it and it was his, and the jury acquitted him in fairly fast time.
after I got found not guilty, Officer Long and Officer Heyman were standing on the side of the prosecutor. And Officer Heyman told me, he said, nigga, you ain't going to walk the street this summer. I say, fuck you.
They told him he wouldn't last the summer.
I looked at him and I said, fuck you. Motherfuck you. At that time, the foreman of the jury came and shook my hand and told me I better watch those guys because they was out to get me. And it wasn't 30 days later that I was charged with this rape case in May of 1988.
And the alleged victim in this case knew Federico, as did her boyfriend, but he and Federico were no longer friendly.
We had a falling out about a gold chain. I let him wear a gold chain, and so we got into an argument about me receiving my gold chain back. And a couple of days after that, they ambushed me. One morning, I was coming out of my girlfriend's house, and the boyfriend walked up to me with a gun in his hand. And the brother is walking on the side of him, and I didn't have no gun. And so when he got up on me, I was able to punch him. And when I hit him, I knocked the gun out of his hand. So we got into a scuffle, beat him and his brother. We was fighting in the middle of the street until we got tired of fighting, and he went and jumped in the car and burnt out. As a direct result, I'm thinking that this is what this arrest may have stemmed from as well.
So now we have two motivated parties, the cops and the alleged victim's boyfriend. And that takes us to May 21st, 1988. And this woman, who was 7 months pregnant at the time, was believed to have been raped and sodomized.
Yeah, according to the state, on May 21st, 1988, the victim is with her boyfriend. They go out at like about midnight. They go get hamburgers or something like that. They have a disagreement. She goes out to the car and sits in his car and then gets up and leaves and starts walking at like, 5 o'clock in the morning. And as she's walking down the street, these guys come in the opposite direction. Three guys, she says, in the car. And they say, hey, you need a ride? She says, no. They go down the block, make a U-turn, come back. And this one guy jumps out of the car and grabs her by the hair and pulls her into an alleyway. And these other two guys get out of the car and hold her down. And allegedly, at that point, the one guy who initially jumps out of the car takes off her underwear. He then assaults her orally and then vaginally. And then she gets up after it's all done and runs off and screams. And she waves down motorists, and good Samaritans take her in and they call the police, and the police come.
And it just so happens that Hammond and Long were the first to respond to the scene. Now, they allegedly found her underwear and her wallet in an alleyway. And she described the main attacker as a light-skinned black man with freckles.
And although Federico is light-skinned, there's no way in the world you could say he has freckles. And she allegedly knows Lobe, never says anything about it being Lobe.
Yes, she stated all three black males who was involved in this were unknown to her.
So she goes to the hospital. She is examined, and a rape kit is created.
Now, keep in mind, the doctor asked her when was the last time she had sex. She said 2 weeks before the rape had took place.
Which would make sense, because after all, she's 7 months pregnant.
Yeah, no, absolutely. This makes sense. And she maintained she wasn't sure whether the assailant didn't ejaculate. That became he didn't ejaculate in the case history, when she was far from sure of that. And it becomes quite relevant a couple of years later when DNA is developing and you can do testing, because she definitely has semen in her.
So that's confusing. She said that she hadn't had sex for 2 weeks prior to the incident. She doesn't know whether the assailant had ejaculated, which the state eventually solidifies as that the assailant had not ejaculated. But there was semen found on the vaginal swab and seminal fluid found on the underwear.
Then the issue becomes, ultimately down the road, she says that when she gets assaulted, the assailant takes off her underwear and she never puts the underwear on again.
So if that is to be believed, then follow me here. The seminal fluid in the underwear is from a different source than the vaginal swab, on which there were 4 or 5 sperm heads. And sperm can survive in a female reproductive tract for up to 5 days. So these sperm heads could have been the result of an earlier unrelated sex act as far as 5 days into the past. Or they could be from pre-ejaculate, which is male glandular fluid that can carry sperm heads from previous ejaculations that were deposited in the male's urethra. But either way, there was an insufficient amount of material to test with the methods available back in 1988 to determine blood type, let alone a DNA profile. So all they had to go on was this undetermined semen source and the description.
Then the next day, she calls up the cops wanting her wallet. And then Hammond and Long, who are police officers, they're not investigators. Traditionally, this case on a sexual assault would be turned over to a sexual assault unit, and detectives would be handling, not patrolmen. And she has this conversation with, I believe it was Long, in which she's looking for her wallet. And he creates a photo array at 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the morning and runs it out to her. And these officers both know LaBey. And these officers have been told by the victim that the assailant had freckles. They put a photo array and they don't attempt to put anybody in there with freckles. Why would you not do that? Then why would you put LaBey in there? And you know he doesn't have freckles.
So they took my photograph, they took my brother's photograph, and they took the photograph of three other guys to her house, and they had her to sign the back of my photograph that I'm the one that raped and sodomized her.
He's arrested within a couple hours. Do you think one of the officers would have said to her, wait a minute, LaBey doesn't have freckles. What are you talking about?
All I know is what I've been told, and that's a half-truth is a whole lie.
For almost a decade, the murder of an 18-year-old girl from a small town in Graves County, Kentucky, went unsolved. Until a local homemaker, a journalist, and a handful of girls came forward with a story.
I'm telling you, we know Quincy killed her. We know.
A story that law enforcement used to convict six people, and that got the citizen investigator on national TV.
Through sheer persistence and nerve, this Kentucky housewife helped give justice to Jessica Curran.
My name is Maggie Freeling. I'm a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, producer, and I wouldn't be here if the truth were that easy to find.
I did not know her, and I did not kill her, or rape, or burn, or any of that other stuff that y'all said.
They literally made me say that I took a match and struck and threw it on her. They made me say that I poured gas on her.
From Lava for Good, this is Graves County, a show about just how far our legal system will go in order to find someone to blame.
America, y'all better wake the hell up. Bad things happens to good people in small towns.
Listen to Graves County in the Bone Valley feed on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And to binge the entire season ad-free, subscribe to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of the On Purpose podcast. Recently, I had a conversation with the one and only Madonna.
When I was broke and I had no friends, nowhere to live, I was held up at gunpoint, I was robbed, all these horrendous things happened to me. I had such an unhappy childhood that whatever happened to me in New York is better than what my life was, so I'm not going back.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
When I told people I was making a podcast about Benghazi, 9 times out of 10, they called me a masochist, rolled their eyes, or just asked, why?
Benghazi, the truth became a web of lies.
It's almost a dirty word, one that connotes conspiracy theory.
Will we ever get the truth about the Benghazi massacre?
Bad faith political warfare, and frankly, bullshit.
We kill the ambassador just to cover something up. You put two and two together.
Was it an overblown distraction or a sinister conspiracy?
Benghazi is a Rosetta Stone for everything that's been going on for the last 20 years.
I'm Leon Nafok from Prologue Projects and Pushkin Industries. This is Fiasco, Benghazi.
What difference at this point does it make?
Yeah, that's right. Lock her up.
Listen to Fiasco, Benghazi on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, you take her initial description of it. You take the idea that she knows LaBey. For 24 hours, she doesn't name him. And then all of a sudden, he's being named to the two police officers who normally wouldn't be investigating a rape. And it's clear they got a relationship with LaVey, and it's a hostile relationship. After LaVey's acquitted in his marijuana case, these cops told him he's never going to make it through the summer. You take the idea that LaVey belongs to this Moorish temple. I mean, you have all these little factors going in, and then that's how the case is made. I mean, it just stinks.
And the smell didn't improve with the introduction of an additional charge. While Frederico was in pretrial detention, the alleged victim claimed that he had called to threaten her on June 1st, 1988, around 11:30 a.m.
She says she was threatened, and based on an officer's testimony, that around that time, LaVey was on the phone.
This is the crazy part. The telephone company said the phone call did not come from out of the St. Louis City Jail where I was being held at that time on that date.
So despite the impossibility, witness tampering, which showed an alleged consciousness of guilt, was added to Frederico's rape and sodomy charges for trial in November 1988. And it seems his defense was well prepared to combat that allegation when the alleged victim took the stand.
They asked her, well, how did she know it was Frederico? She said, I remember his voice in the alley. But the officer that came in and testified for me, his name was Darrell Pitchford. He testified that he worked the floor that I was on that day. And I could not have been on that phone because at the time that they saying that phone call came in, we were locked down preparing for visits that Wednesday afternoon. And we locked down at 10:30.
There was no connection that he called her other than her saying it. It was really fishy. And I don't know actually how he got convicted on it.
But there's much less confusion about how they managed to make the rape and sodomy charges stick.
She got up on the stand and she stated that she remembered me from the neighborhood and she identified me. She pointed to me and said, yeah, that's him. That's Frederico sitting at the table right there with my attorney, Andrew Hernandez.
And then somehow the defense didn't impeach this in court identification with her initial description. After all, Frederico doesn't have freckles. But instead, they took a less direct route, starting with Officer James Long.
There's a pretrial hearing, and Long says that she said the guy had freckles, right? So then they go to trial. Long testifies, not a word is elicited from him about her saying the guy has freckles. Right.
So twice already they had squandered this impeachment evidence, and it didn't come out until Frederico's girlfriend finally took the stand.
She talks about right after Frederico gets arrested on this case, she's up at the circuit attorney's office. They're trying to say, wait a minute, there's no way he could be the person that did this. And the victim is there, and these two women have a conversation. And during that conversation, the victim says to Frederico's girlfriend that, in fact, the guy had freckles. And so the lawyer brings it out from the girlfriend, who's his alibi witness, right? And of course, you know, the girlfriend alibi witness is unbelievable because she's going to lie to protect him. He doesn't bring it out from anybody else. And then the victim says, when she's testified, no, I never said to this woman at the circuit attorney's office that the guy had freckles. Meanwhile, the cop, who they're saying is trying to frame him, says she said this and it never comes out.
And so in addition to the fumbling of this discrepancy in the description, they were also prevented from offering evidence of the officer's motivations.
They try to prove that the cops basically were out to get him. And the judge refused to let him get into evidence that he had been acquitted on marijuana. These two officers testified, and a jury found them not believable.
So that strategy was neutered. And then the rape kit evidence was presented. Medical expert Joseph Crow testified about finding four or five sperm heads without their tails on the vaginal swab. Now, sperm begin to degrade immediately upon ejaculation, and tails degrade faster than the heads. And remember, sperm can survive up to 5 days in a female reproductive tract.
He basically talks about, based on the sperm heads without tails, how long that indicates they could have been there. And the idea was is that that's an indication that they were deposited well before this event happened.
And the prosecutor asked him, said, isn't it possible that sperm could have been left from pre-ejaculation leakage? He said, yeah.
Now, they posited that the assailant had not ejaculated. But this testimony makes room for two possibilities. One, an earlier sex act. Or two, that the assailant may have deposited pre-ejaculate. However, with the primitive methods that were available back in 1988, Crow testified that they couldn't pull a blood type, let alone a DNA profile, from either the swab or the underwear seminal stain due to the small amount of material available, which Crow and the prosecution implied was further proof that the material had been from a previous unrelated sex act, which at maximum happened 5 days into the past by today's knowledge. And according to Crow, at that time, 24 hours max.
Keep in mind, he has a clear report in his possession that says that the victim had not had sex for 2 weeks prior to the rape happening. But he comes to court and he testifies that it's possible that sperm could have been there from an old sex act. But it could never be there from an old sex act if she had not had sex for 2 weeks prior to the rape happening.
Yet that critical impeachment evidence evaded defense counsel.
The lawyers representing LaVey don't have a legible copy of the medical record. And as a result, they don't know that she's told medical people within an hour of being brought in after being assaulted that she hadn't had sex in 2 weeks with anybody. The original legible copy of the medical record goes into evidence.
And this legible copy with the statement about no sexual activity for 2 weeks was not discovered by Federico's team until 2014. Now, perhaps the prosecution shared this illegible copy in the hope that this detail would not be discovered. So, with the presence of the sperm heads neatly accounted for as either a previous unrelated encounter or the assailant's pre-ejaculate, without any possibility of identifying the source at that time, the jury was sent to deliberate.
Yes, they convicted me, sent me to prison, gave me 85 years. 35 years for the rape, 35 years for the sodomy, and 15 years for the tampering with a witness. 85 years.
All I know is what I've been told, and that's a half-truth is a whole lie.
For almost a decade, the murder of an 18-year-old girl from a small town in Graves County, Kentucky, went unsolved until a local homemaker, a journalist, and a handful of girls came forward with a story.
I'm telling you, we know Quincy killed her. We know.
A story that law enforcement used to convict six people and that got the citizen investigator on national TV.
Through sheer persistence and nerve, this Kentucky housewife helped give justice to Jessica Curran.
My name is Maggie Freeling. I'm a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, producer, and I wouldn't be here if the truth were that easy to find.
I did not know her, and I did not kill her, or rape, or burn, or any of that other stuff that y'all said.
They literally made me say that I took a match and struck and threw it on her. They made me say that I poured gas on her.
From Lava for Good, this is Graves County, a show about just how far our legal system will go in order to find someone to blame.
America, y'all better wake the hell up. Bad things happen to good people in small towns.
Listen to Graves County in the Bone Valley feed on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And to binge the entire season ad-free, subscribe to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of the On Purpose podcast. Recently, I had a conversation with the one and only Madonna.
When I was broke and I had no friends, nowhere to live, I was held up at gunpoint, I was robbed. All these horrendous things happened to me. I had such an unhappy childhood that whatever happened to me in New York is better than what my life was, so I'm not going back.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
When I told people I was making a podcast about Benghazi, 9 times out of 10, they called me a masochist, rolled their eyes, or just asked, why?
Benghazi, the truth became a web of lies.
It's almost a dirty word, one that connotes conspiracy theory.
Will we ever get the truth about the Benghazi massacre?
Bad faith political warfare, and frankly, bullshit.
We kill the ambassador just to cover something up. You put two and two together.
Was it an overblown distraction or a sinister conspiracy?
Benghazi is a Rosetta Stone for everything that's been going on for the last 20 years.
I'm Leon Nafok from Prologue Projects and Pushkin Industries. This is Fiasco, Benghazi.
What difference at this point does it make?
Yeah, that's right. Lock her up.
Listen to Fiasco, Benghazi on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I've been fighting this case ever since I've been in prison. I've been in the library ever since I've been in prison. I've been doing everything it is that I could do in fighting this situation.
After he exhausted his direct appeals, he filed a post-conviction motion in 2001 for DNA testing of all the relevant evidence, most importantly, the vaginal swab and the underwear.
The victim gave a deposition in September of 1988 that she did not know if her rapist ejaculated in her vagina. So I explained to the court that it was possible that this sperm that we found could belong to the victim's rapist. Therefore, I should be entitled to have the DNA testing done.
Jim McCloskey from our group got involved way back in, you know, 03, 04.
McCloskey had presented a top DNA scientist at that time, Robert Burke. He was able to convince the court that I should be entitled to DNA testing. And we came up on Reliogene Technologies, Inc.
Reliogene conducted Y-STR testing, which analyzes Y-chromosomal DNA to identify paternal lineages. So this testing could include the source of biological material as well as any close male relatives. And they tested the vaginal swab as well as the underwear.
So when the DNA come back not to match me, the state began to say, well, the evidence belonged to the victim's boyfriend, as it was stated in the trial. This could be from either the rapist or it could be from the victim's boyfriend. We'll never know because he never tested whether or not it came from him.
Now, remember, during trial, and even at this time in post-conviction litigation, the legible medical record showing the alleged victim's claim of celibacy for the 2 weeks prior to the incident had not yet been discovered by Federico's legal team. So even though the prosecution had submitted the legible medical records with that information into evidence, the trial testimony of the medical expert and the alleged victim reflects that the vaginal sperm was either pre-ejaculate from the assailant or from an earlier sexual encounter with her boyfriend.
Her boyfriend was in the courtroom right next door to us on drug charges. And as a direct result, the sheriff was able to go over there and get him and bring him to the courtroom where we were at. And he agreed to give a DNA sample, and it came back not to match him. And the judge ordered the prosecutor to go produce the victim, come in and testify why that DNA doesn't match her boyfriend.
And so when the victim gets on the stand, Federico's, he's not present while she's testifying because she doesn't want to face him. And they have him out of the courtroom. And she says, oh, what really freaked me out was the freckles on his face, right? Clearly not remembering her denial. And the lawyer doesn't pick up on it. Wait a minute, you never said the guy had freckles. It just goes by the wayside. It seems to me it's incumbent upon the judge when someone gives you such a distinctive identifier is to say, wait a minute, he doesn't have freckles.
But the discrepancy in the description, again, slipped through their fingers. And now, when asked to explain how both her boyfriend and Federico were excluded from the vaginal sperm, she once again contradicted her statement from the yet-to-be-discovered legible medical records.
She suddenly testifies that she had sex with four different people within a day or two of this assault. And the boyfriend who she's living with, he's excluded. And obviously, Frederico's excluded. And then there was this other guy who had passed away.
So she said that she had sex with a guy named Fred Knox the week before that. So the FBI were able to provide us with a vial of his blood, and they tested it. When it didn't match Fred Knox, she said she had sex with two other guys that she don't remember.
So we don't know whether the semen is from these two unknowns that she has consensual sex with.
So when the DNA test results excluded both sources of the vaginal sperm, the narrative completely changed, and three new possible sources were added, two of whom could never be confirmed nor denied. And since this information wasn't part of the trial record, what else isn't real? What we do know is that the profile found on the vaginal swab was also present on the seminal stain in the underwear.
And then the issue becomes with this judge is that, well, she says she never put her underwear back on. So therefore, the semen in the underwear cannot have been from the assailant.
If we're basing our logic off of her word, again, we need to ask, what else isn't real? After all, at this point in post-conviction, the court and Federico's team were still operating under the misapprehension that she hadn't claimed to be celibate for 2 weeks prior to this incident.
Jim McCluskey retained Rick Sandell, local counsel. They did a habeas in 14, and that's when they found the legible copy of the medical records and kind of brought a habeas action in Missouri state court. And the habeas action was basically that the DNA hearing really wasn't fair because they suppressed this medical record. The argument got shot down by the fact that the actual medical record went into evidence at the trial.
So sharing this illegible medical record, the prosecution appears to have just made an honest mistake, right? Yeah. Okay. And I got a bridge to sell you as well. Maybe it was deceit. Anyway, ultimately, the state ignored this statement about 2 weeks of celibacy while also submitting the legible medical records into evidence, all while bearing no responsibility. The onus falls solely on both trial and appellate counsel.
It could have been known. Yeah. The words are due diligence. If you exercise due diligence, you would have known this, idiot.
So by ignoring the initial statement and not being discovered, the prosecution and the alleged victim could create a narrative based on what appears to be a false premise, that the alleged victim had not been celibate for 2 weeks, thereby leaving the narrative open to first the boyfriend as a contributor at trial, then during post-conviction, Fred Knox, and finally, these two unknown contributors, on which the 2007-2008 denial was based upon.
I should have been released from prison once it didn't match Fred Knox, but the judge said she believed the victim, saying that she had sex with two other guys prior to the rape happening, and none of this evidence was ever disclosed to me. And as a direct result, I've been sitting in prison all of this time because the judge said she believed what the victim said is the absolute truth. But she did not know. The victim told the doctor who examined her that she had not had sex for 2 weeks prior to the rape happening. And every court we turn to give us the opportunity to show that I'm being held illegally, they disregard this evidence like it's nothing.
Again, zero culpability is placed on the prosecutor, while the court places the onus on Federico and whoever was representing him at any stage to have found the legible copy of the medical record, rather than have just naively accepted what the prosecution shared.
The prosecutor told my lawyer at the time all of the documents looked just alike. All the time they had State's Exhibit 20B was a clear, a concise copy of the medical report, and the medical report say that she hadn't had sex for 2 weeks, but the prosecutor had a duty and obligation, according to Napier versus Illinois, not to foster false evidence before the court. And I tried to bring it to the Court of Appeals because they have what you call a manifest injustice exception to open up the case to allow you to go back in and overcome the procedural bar.
In Missouri, the post-conviction rules are so restrictive about when you have to file, how you have to file. It's very hostile to people trying to prove that they're innocent. The rules are all geared against you, really.
Because I'm procedurally barred, nobody want to hear what I got to say.
And it appears that the skullduggery goes even deeper.
When they first gave us the illegible documents, I had a prosecutor down there who told us if we didn't like how the documents looked, we should contact our supervisor. His name was George Peach. When my attorney Hernandez said he wouldn't make time for him to discuss none of the reports with him, I said, I'll write him on my own shit. I sent him a letter on July the 7th, 1988, and he never wrote back. But this is the crazy part about George Peach. George Peach stole money out of the St. Louis Circuit Attorney's Petty Cash Fund to buy sex from an undercover cop and was caught in a sting down in the city of St. Louis. He was fired from there.
So it seems that both his trial attorney and Federico both made inquiries about this illegible document and were met with the elected circuit attorney, George Peach, who eventually resigned in 1992 behind this alleged financial and sexual impropriety. And it appears that this Peach had tried to pawn off his impropriety on a man who he had already wrongfully convicted of rape, a guy who none other than Barry Scheck himself had helped to exonerate, a man named Larry Johnson.
George Peach used Larry Johnson's name as the individual who was buying the sex from the undercover cop when he got caught up in the state, knowing that Larry Johnson was in prison serving life sentence. And he used that man's name in vain. And Larry Johnson was later exonerated by Barry Sheck. And Barry Sheck had to talk real bad about the prosecutor then who took over George Peach's position, which was Jennifer Joyce, because she fought him on the same thing that I'm being fought for right now with this guy named Gabe Gore down in the St. Louis Circuit Attorney's Office right now.
We had a meeting with the Circuit Attorney Gore. They were unreceptive to the reinvestigation of the police officers and what happened in the case. I understand there's a new person that's now at the Circuit Attorney's Office that's handling claims of innocence and reviewing them. So, I mean, that's one avenue.
Recently, I filed a motion in the United States District Court, Eastern District of Missouri, because they have a DNA database now for YSTR DNA testing. I filed a motion for judge down there to allow me to put the evidence in the YSTR DNA database to find the individual that we're looking for. Also, I want to bring to your attention, they charged me as a prior persistent and a class X offender. Class X offender requires me to serve 80% of the time in prison, right? But guess what? In order to be a class X offender, I have to be charged with class A or class B felonies. I've been charged with unclassified felonies. That doesn't qualify as a class B or class A felony. And as a direct result, they've been having me serve 80% of this sentence, which normally I would be required to serve 30% and be released on parole.
30% of 85 years is 25 and a half. And since Federico has already served 37 long, miserable fucking years, he'd be parole eligible now. So maybe, just maybe, Missouri would be willing to consider that road. But in the meantime, we hope that someone who's listening may have useful information about this case. And if you do, please come forward.
They can reach out to Paul with any information that they may think that would help our situation.
We'll link Paul's contact info at Centurion Ministries in the episode description. So now we're going to go to closing arguments. And Federico and Paul, what can I say except for thank you from all of us here at Wrongful Conviction for joining us here today and sharing this harrowing story. And now I'm just going to kick back in my chair and close my eyes and listen to anything else you guys feel is left to be said.
The injustice of the case and how weak a case it is, and the lack of credibility of basically all the characters that put him away for his life is just incredible. Everybody is kind of just looks the other way. Sometimes facts to become known and put together take a lot of time. And the idea that time becomes the bar to the consideration of a full record, that I find just so scary. Throughout history, we've always learned that sometimes time is the truth. And in Missouri, because of all these rules that they have, they say it's just the opposite. I just find it so frightening that you don't care. You simply don't care if you have somebody that's innocent. And if the person has some questionable background, do you even care less about whether you've heaped this immense injustice on them?
I'm focused, man. I'm focused on getting out. I'm focused on getting out, and I'm thankful that I got guys like you, Jason, and whoever else that I can get to push me to the limits where I need to go.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts. I want to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kathleen Fink, as well as my fellow executive producers, Jeff Kempler, Kevin Wardis, and Jeff Clyburn. The music in this production was supplied by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer, Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us across all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on Instagram at It's Jason Flom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1.
We have worked hard to ensure that all facts reported in this show are accurate. The views and opinions expressed by the individuals featured in this show are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of Lava for Good.
Thank you.
The murder of an 18-year-old girl in Graves County, Kentucky, went unsolved for years. Until a local housewife, a journalist, and a handful of girls came forward with a story.
America, y'all better wake the hell up. Bad things happens to good people in small towns.
Listen to Graves County on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And to binge the entire season ad-free, subscribe to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of the On Purpose podcast. Recently, I had a conversation with the one and only Madonna.
When I was broke and I had no friends, nowhere to live, I was held up at gunpoint, I was robbed. All these horrendous things happened to me. I had such an unhappy childhood that whatever happened to me in New York is better than what my life was, so I'm not going back.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
When I told people I was making a podcast about Benghazi, 9 times out of 10, they called me a masochist, rolled their eyes, or just asked, why?
Benghazi, the truth became a web of lies.
From Prologue Projects and Pushkin Industries, this is Fiasco, Benghazi.
What difference at this point does it make?
Listen to Fiasco, Benghazi on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.